If you look at the syllabus, you'll see that it lists your respiration procedure is listed for this week and next week. And that's not because of how much there is to do in that chapter, which does seem like a lot to do. That's because we're not going to actually do most of that. The reason we're doing it in 2 weeks is because this first week is largely a practice week. It's for you to get an idea of how your data are going to be collected. I mean, you're going to actually collect data today, but these won't be your data that you actually write up. You're going to learn how to do the basic procedure, but then you're going to come up with, as a group, with some actual experiment to conduct next time. And so have that ready as you come in next time, because you're going to have to right away get into doing the actual experiment. Okay? Today, though, you're going to basically find out things that can go wrong and figure out ways in which you can improve the technique. But you'll see how it works. And we're using a plant and an animal. Elodia are the plants that are mentioned in the manual. That's correct. But the manual mentions snails. I think it's procedure 3 is the one that you'll roughly be following, although there will be some minor differences. Instead of snails, though, we're using crayfish. There are bigger ones over there in those, and these ones are smaller ones, but they're all crayfish. I need to talk, though, just in general about respiration for a little bit. One thing I want to point out is that the manual says that all organisms respire. Not true. All organisms do use their fuel for energy, but that's respiration is only part of that. If we think about the entire catabolism, the complete oxidation or catabolism of glucose, that can involve respiration, but it involves more than just respiration. What is the first part of the catabolism of glucose? Catabolism, by the way, is one half of metabolism. Metabolism as an overall, which is the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in an organism. Metabolism, it can be broken down into catabolism and anabolism. Catabolism is breaking bigger things down into smaller things. Anabolism is building up bigger things by combining smaller things. And in general, when you catabolize something, when you break a complex particle down into smaller ones, you also release energy in the process, which is why catabolizing our fuels gives us usable energy. That's what we do with the food that we eat. We first digest it into small enough molecules that can then be catabolized once they're in our cells to get the energy to produce ATP using that energy. But anyway, what is the first major process in the catabolism of glucose? Right, glycolysis, which itself is a 10-step biochemical pathway. It's 10 separate reactions happening one after another. But we call all of those combined glycolysis. Well, glycolysis happens in all cells. And it gets you some usable energy. You have to spend 2 ATP for glycolysis to occur, but it's worth it because you end up making 4 ATP, so you make a net of 2 ATP per glucose molecule. But by the time you're done with that, you haven't completely spent the fuel, because to get as much energy as possible out of a fuel molecule means that you need to completely dismantle its carbon skeleton. And glucose has how many carbons in it? Right, it's a hexose, 6 carbon sugar. By completely dismantling that 6 carbon sugar, you'll end up with something that is just 1 carbon in each particle, right? What is that that final waste product? Carbon dioxide. But that doesn't occur in glycolysis, right? Glycolysis partially dismantles the carbon skeleton, which is why you get some energy out of it to make ATP with. But what we do with glycolysis is take a 6-carbon compound and break it down into 2 3-carbon compounds. What are those 3-carbon compounds? Right, pyruvate molecules. So pyruvate represents the end of glycolysis, and it's important to realize that that pyruvate still is valuable fuel. It's only partially spent fuel. So a cell can get a lot more ATP from the energy that's still in that pyruvate if it goes on to conduct cellular respiration, which is after glycolysis. But that's only one alternative. There are 2 alternatives, so it's like a fork in the road after cellular respiration. That pyruvate can be dealt with in 2 ways. It can go on and be further oxidized, completely oxidized, so that all you have left from what was originally glucose is CO2, 6 individual CO2 molecules. No more usable energy in CO2. It's worthless as far as fuel is concerned. And that will require an electron acceptor to do that, a final electron acceptor, if that route is to be taken. And the cell wants to, of course, because it's a huge payoff. You make a lot more ATP for that original glucose molecule if you completely break it down. But if you don't have a way to conduct cellular respiration, then there's an alternative, the other path in the fork in the road, which is fermentation. All right? But I still haven't really said what respiration is. What is it that makes cellular respiration respiration? It really is the pumping of protons through a membrane to create a gradient. That's what makes it respiration. And where does this occur? Glycolysis happens out in the cytosol. Where does cellular respiration occur? It happens in a mitochondrion if it is a eukaryotic cell. Because remember, only eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles, including mitochondria. There are, though, prokaryotic cells that can respire. They don't have mitochondria, but they do have a plasma membrane, and they can fold that back and forth, make it an elaborate folding that does basically the same job as the mitochondrial membranes. So they respire for the same reason. Like I said, respiration involves the pumping of protons through a membrane, creating a proton gradient. Okay? Now that can occur either with oxygen's help or the help of some other molecule. And therefore there's 2 major kinds of respiration. Aerobic respiration, which is what we do. Aerobic meaning requiring oxygen, and anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic respiration is not fermentation, because fermentation is not respiration. Okay? Anaerobic fermentation works just like aerobic fermentation, except it's something other than oxygen doing oxygen's job. So what is that job that oxygen does? It acts as the final electron acceptor, exactly. That's almost the whole reason we breathe oxygen. Almost the only reason we use oxygen in our bodies is to serve as the final electron acceptor. Well, like I said, respiration has to involve a pumping of protons. What is it that actually pumps these protons? It's a collection of proteins, mostly, proteins and other molecules, that are embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Whenever you use the word pump, you're talking about active transport, because pumping means moving something against its concentration gradient. No, but that's going to be involved in the next step. So in the mitochondrion, first of all, remember that a mitochondrion is doubly membrane-bounded. So there's an outer membrane, inner membrane, and therefore there's 2 compartments within the mitochondrion. There's the intermembrane space, which is just the compartment between the 2 membranes, as the name indicates. But then the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane is called the matrix. The pumping of protons in a eukaryotic cell for respiration occurs through the inner mitochondrial membrane. And what's happening is that protons get taken from the matrix, pumped through that inner membrane into the intermembrane space. And that creates a gradient of protons. There will be a higher concentration of protons in the inner membrane space than the matrix. The reason that's important is because a gradient is a form of stored energy. And that gradient of protons that's created actually represents energy that used to be in the glucose molecule. Whenever you're pumping ions or anything else, moving them against their concentration gradient, you have to be spending energy to do that, right? The energy came from the food, which is why the gradient that results will represent energy that was in the fuel molecule. But what is it? What is the source of energy that allows these pumps to work? The electrons that got stripped from the food, exactly. So fuel molecules are useful because they can be oxidized. Remember what oxidation means. It means removal of electrons. When you're stripping electrons from the fuel molecule, glucose or any other fuel, but glucose is the master fuel, you're not only removing electrons, you're also removing protons. In other words, you're dehydrogenating the fuel. You're picking off hydrogen atoms from the fuel, which is oxidation, because you're removing electrons. But you're removing protons at the same time. A hydrogen atom is just an electron and a proton. Okay? Those electrons represent energy that used to be in the fuel. How do electrons power the pumping of protons? Those protein complexes that are the pumps, what also are they? These are the things that are embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. No, they are members of electron transport chains. Okay? Electron transport is part of respiration. So these complexes of proteins and other molecules that are part of that inner membrane receive electrons. It acts kind of like a bucket brigade. Old-fashioned way of putting out a fire, right? They get a line of people, put a bucket in the first person's hand, he gives it to the next person, so on, then he dumps it on the fire. So that first member of the electron transport chain receives electrons, passes it immediately off to the next member. And then so on down the line. Every time electrons get transferred from one member to the next of the electron transport chain, the electrons end up getting closer to whatever atomic nucleus they are associated with at that time. In other words, they're going down gradually in energy level. So the passing of electrons in electron transport releases energy. And it's that energy that actually powers the pumping of protons, because these complexes that are actually the chain itself are also pumps. Right? But what powers them as pumps is the fact that they're getting energy from these electrons. All right? So where do the electrons come from that the electron transport chain receives? NADH, exactly, which is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's a coenzyme. But it works as a little taxi, basically. It's carrying electrons from the food, from the fuel molecule, that got stripped off as hydrogen atoms. And just like a taxi, it has the full version or the empty version, right? But in chemical terms, we say the reduced version or the oxidized version. The oxidized version of the coenzyme is the empty taxi. And for NAD, that version is NAD+, right? So in whatever fuel molecule you have with however big a carbon skeleton, when you strip off a couple hydrogen atoms, you really have two electrons and two protons to work with, right? Well, if you take just one of those electrons and add it to NAD+, that neutralizes the positive charge. That would just make it NAD. One more electron, the other electron, plus one of the protons is a hydrogen atom, so that makes it NADH. And then you still have a one proton left over. That's why most books will list the reduced form of NAD as NADH and H+. The H+ is not connected. It's just in solution. But it's there because it came from the food. Okay? So the NADH now is the full taxi, and it drives over to one of these electron transport chains in the mitochondrial membrane and releases its two electrons and proton. Now you have two protons in solution, but the two electrons get delivered to the electron transport chain and then passed one by one. And like I said, it goes down in energy level gradually. That allows these electron transport chain members to pump protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space. And so now, the usable form of energy that came from the glucose molecule is in the form of this proton gradient. As long as you allow, I mean, the reason gradients work as energy sources is because you can put them to work for you somehow, just like a gravitational gradient can be put to work for you, right? It takes effort to move water uphill, just like it takes effort to pump these protons in the reverse direction that they want to diffuse in. But once you get that water uphill, it will automatically, on its own, go downhill, right? And if you design a system in such a way that you take advantage of that falling down, like put a water wheel in the way, then the falling water will turn the wheel, which might turn a millstone and grind corn for you or whatever, right? You can put that to work, that gradient. Similarly, if you can somehow force the protons that are going to want to diffuse back into the matrix on their own to do some work for you, you're all set. And that's exactly what cells do with their ATP synthase molecules that you mentioned. Hydrogen ions are ions. They are fully charged particles, and therefore they're not able to easily get through just the phospholipid bilayer of that membrane, right? Because those lipid tails are hydrophobic. They don't want any charged particles next to them. So the only places these protons can get back into the matrix through that membrane are at these ATP synthase molecules, acting like little water wheels, basically. They actually spin, and that spinning causes ADP and inorganic phosphate to come together to make ATP. Adenosine diphosphate gets phosphorylated into adenosine triphosphate. And you end up making a lot more ATP that way than you do by just glycolysis, which is why it's such a big payoff. Okay, but glycolysis not only makes that net 2 ATP per glucose, it also, in the process of rearranging the carbon skeleton of glucose, produces NADH. And in fact, glycolysis can't continue unless you have NAD+ to receive those electrons and proton. So you have to have NAD+ or glycolysis will come to a halt. Okay? Well, cellular respiration works as long as you have electrons being transported down the chains. But that means you have to have something taking electrons from that final member of the chain, the guy who throws the bucket on the fire, right? In order to receive another bucket, he has to get rid of his. And that is why we breathe oxygen. Oxygen's job is to take the electrons from that final member. And what happens to oxygen in the process? Well, it's receiving electrons, so it's becoming reduced, right, chemically. It not only receives electrons, though, it receives protons as well. And so when you add electrons and protons together, you really have hydrogen atoms. That's why when oxygen gets reduced, the oxygen that you breathe in becomes water. Okay? If oxygen's not around, then that last member of the chain can't dump its electrons off to anyone else, and therefore can't receive anyone from any more from the next to last. The whole chain is going to fill up. That means the first member of the chain can't receive any more electrons from NADH. And therefore, NADH is going to stay with its passenger. It can't dump its passenger off. And eventually, the whole fleet of taxis, the whole number of NAD molecules you have, will be in the form of NADH, which means none of them will be able to drive back to glycolysis and pick up any more electrons, and glycolysis itself will shut down, even though glycolysis doesn't require oxygen. Okay? So that's why you don't have cellular respiration without oxygen, if you're an anaerobic respirer. But also, if there is no final electron acceptor, that means you're forced to take that alternative route at the end of cellular respiration. And what is that alternative route? Fermentation, exactly. Fermentation does not actually produce any ATP on its own. The ATP that's associated with fermentation is really glycolysis ATP. But fermentation allows glycolysis to continue when you don't have a final electron acceptor to let cellular respiration work. Okay, so imagine you have a whole fleet of NADs that are in NADH form, reduced form. The only thing that fermentation accomplishes is the reoxidation of NADH back into NAD+, so it can then go pick up more electrons from glucose, allowing glycolysis to continue. Now, the book claims that there are two types of fermentation. That's another lie they told you. There are many types of fermentation. There's really two that humans are mostly interested in. One of those is the type of fermentation that humans do, so we're interested in it for that reason. That's lactate fermentation. The other is alcohol fermentation, which yeast, for example, do. And we're interested in that because that makes alcohol for us for beverages, but also it's useful in baking, all kinds of processes. Whatever the variation of respiration fermentation that a given species uses, it all accomplishes the same thing, which is reoxidation of NADH into NAD+. That's what it's trying to do. So when we make lactate, it's not because we want to make lactate. It's because we have to in order to make NAD+. So our fermentation, lactate fermentation, is pretty direct. We take the pyruvate that glycolysis spits out, and we reduce the pyruvate. Remember, reduction means we're going to stick some electrons onto it. What's the source of those electrons? NADH. So that in the process of reducing pyruvate, which makes it into lactate, we turn NADH into NAD+. That's the whole reason for fermentation. Alcohol fermentation is a little bit more indirect. The pyruvate that's spit out by glycolysis first gets decarboxylated, meaning you strip a carbon and two oxygens off. In other words, you take carbon dioxide off of it. What's left is acetaldehyde, and then you reduce the acetaldehyde, or the yeast does. That turns it into ethanol, alcohol that's in all beverages, all alcoholic beverages, and produces NAD+ again, the goal. But this is why beer, for instance, is carbonated, because you take that carbon dioxide off of the pyruvate in the process. Okay, so different versions of fermentation in different species, but they all have the common theme that they reoxidize NADH into NAD+. Well, you don't really care about fermentation in this exercise, though. What you're concerned with is cellular respiration, and we're using an animal and a plant, as I said, and there's a potential problem with doing that because the plant, of course, is photosynthetic, right? Both the complete oxidation of glucose as a process, which means glycolysis and cellular respiration end to end, and photosynthesis as an overall process can be summarized by a single reaction. Even though it takes many, many reactions to actually go through the whole process, you can summarize the whole process by saying, here's what you start with, here's what you end up with, right? And what is the summary reaction for cellular for the complete oxidation of glucose? Well, you start with glucose, right? C6H12O6. What else do you need? Oxygen. And what do you make? You make H2O because your oxygen that you breathe receives electrons and protons from the fuel. And what's left of the fuel? CO2. But since this is catabolism, you're breaking this big thing into small things, you also get some energy that's put out in the situation, right? Some of that energy is lost as heat. Nothing you can do about that. But some of it gets captured in the form of ATP molecules that you're able to produce. Well, the summary reaction for photosynthesis is exactly the reverse. Photosynthesis itself doesn't happen in the reverse way. But the summary reaction is exactly the reverse. So in other words, cellular respiration uses what cellular respiration spits out. The two things a photosynthetic organism needs are carbon dioxide as building blocks to make sugar. And of course, you have to water a plant, right? So water, that becomes sugar. Not only glucose, but other sugars can be made. And oxygen is a waste material. Where did the oxygen come from? Well, in the process, water gets split. And you make oxygen out of it. Well, where is the energy? It has to be put into the situation for photosynthesis, right? It comes from sunlight, obviously. Or artificial light, if that's what you're using, but light energy. Anyway, the reason that I'm mentioning this is because what you're really interested in doing today is measuring how much cellular respiration is occurring in your organism. Pretty straightforward in the crayfish because it has mitochondria, but it does not have chloroplasts. So it's going to respire, but it's not going to be photosynthesizing. A plant, though, can do both. Keep in mind that a photosynthetic organism also has mitochondria for exactly the same reason. So it's able to do both of these processes. And since they undo each other, if you allow the plant to photosynthesize at the same time you're trying to measure its rate of cellular respiration, some of the CO2 that it's making for cellular respiration will be used in photosynthesis. So if you are trying to measure cellular respiration by measuring how much CO2 builds up, you'll have an error if you allow that plant to be photosynthesizing at the same time. That's why we have opaque aluminum foil over here. You have to make sure you completely cover the chamber that you have your plant in for the whole time that you're making, that you're allowing the buildup of CO2 to occur. Okay? Okay. Now, as for the measurement itself, I said we're going to be measuring how much CO2 builds up. We're not going to use a carbon dioxide analyzer, which is how most scientists would do it. We're going to do a crude method. We're going to rely on the fact, though, that there is a really important reaction occurring between carbon dioxide and water. And I think we even talked about it before, didn't we? I don't know, I get my courses mixed up, but anyway, carbon dioxide and water can react in a reversible manner, to produce what? Anyone know? Carbonic acid, right, H2CO3. But carbonic acid will quickly dissociate, like acids do, right, in solution. And so it'll become a hydrogen ion and a bicarbonate ion. Well, by Le Chatelier's principle, if you add something to the left side of a reaction, it's going to force it to the right. Right? You remember that from chemistry? Or maybe you haven't even had chemistry. I don't know. But anyway, it should just make sense, common sense, kind of, right? You add something to the left side, it's going to force everything to the right. Which means the more CO2 that you get from the respiration that's occurring by your organism, the more hydrogen ions you're going to produce in solution. In other words, you're going to acidify the solution more and more. And this is exactly why you can't hold your breath forever. If you hold your breath and you don't blow that CO2 off, it reacts with the water in your blood and acidifies your blood. And your brain senses pH very, very well. Just a tiny drop in pH is going to force you to breathe. You don't have any say in the matter. Anyway, this is how you're actually going to get your measurement of CO2. It's an indirect measurement. What you're going to do is titrate your solutions after the given amount of time is up. And importantly, very importantly, you take your organism out. Whether it's the plant or the animal, take it out at the end. Do not add any of this titrant to the vessel the organism is in. It'll kill it. So don't abuse your organisms. But after you've taken it out and you have the water that it's been in for that whole time, that's acidified to a certain degree, right? Well, to undo the acid, the effect of the acid, you need to add a base. A strong base, which is sodium hydroxide in this case, a strong base, just like a strong acid, will completely dissociate. So it'll be no longer sodium hydroxide, it'll be sodium ions and hydroxide ions. And every hydroxide ion can join with a proton or hydrogen ion that's produced by the organism to just go back into a water molecule, neutral. It's just a matter, in other words, of keeping track of how much sodium hydroxide it takes to bring your solution back to neutral pH. And how are we doing that? How do we know what the neutral pH is? We don't have a pH meter that we're working with. Anyone know? We're using an indicator molecule, which is phenolphthalein. And that's really important for you to remember to put into your solution, once again, after you've already taken the organism out. Because without the indicator, you won't have any idea when it gets to neutral. It won't have any appearance change. But the phenolphthalein is clear, transparent, until it gets to neutral pH. So when it's acidic, it's colorless. When it becomes basic, it turns pink. So all you need to do is carefully, this is another important thing, every time you do start a titration, carefully write down what the original volume is in your burette. This glass tube is a burette. Basically just a graduated cylinder with a valve at the end. But you need to write down your initial volume. Because once you get to the point where the solution turns just barely pink, then you'll write down your final volume and figure out how much you actually had to deliver to that solution in order to neutralize it. It's going to be a different beginning volume every time, so don't forget to write down your initial volume. And don't assume it's zero. Actually, get up there and make sure you look at it at eye level whenever you look at a meniscus to get a good reading. Okay? But as far as turning pink is concerned, you just want it to be barely pink. As soon as it gets to the point where it's no longer clear, that's pink enough. That's stop at that point. But what you'll notice is that when it gets close to the equivalence point, just adding one drop of sodium hydroxide will turn it pink right where that drop hits. But then if you swirl it, it'll go back into clear as you mix it up. What you want is that final drop should be the one that even after swirling, it'll still be just barely pink to look through. Not dark pink, just not clear anymore. That's when you should stop. Okay? So, that's how you titrate. Now we have to think about a couple other things. You're going to express your relative rates of cellular respiration per volume of organism. rather than per gram. It's going to be per milliliter. And that's because the very hard and also metabolically inactive exoskeleton would make mass not a very good choice in normalizing these measurements. So you want to do it by volume of organism, which means you need to measure the volume of your crayfish. Well, the Elodia needs to be measured the volume of it too. But how do you measure the volume of a crayfish? By water displacement, exactly. And that's what these modified beakers are for. Sometimes they work well, sometimes not. But the idea here is that you fill this thing up with water until it starts spilling out the spill tube, and then just let it sit until all of the water that's going to spill out of it spills out. Then you put your crayfish in there, and it's going to bring the water level up, so it's going to spill some more. But you collect the water that spills out after you put the crayfish in, and however much you collect, you measure the volume of that, that's the volume of the crayfish. Sometimes it doesn't come out well, though, so let me know if you run into problems with that. It's not the only way it's possible to do this, but try to use one that has the top of the tube cut off like this one does. It has a channel in it. Those seem to work a little better. Anyway, you're going to have to do that for both the animal and the plant. The plant's a little more, well, you have to do it for both of them. You don't have to have the volume of your plant exactly match the volume of your animal, but you should get it close. Important, and the reason that they don't have to be exact, you do have to write down what the exact one is for both, though. The reason they don't have to exactly match each other is because you're going to divide by the volume in your final measurements. So you're taking care of that variable by dividing by volume, right? But importantly, you need to have exactly the same amount of water in each of your two chambers, your plant one and your animal one. Because if you have a hell of a lot of water in there, of course it's not going to get as acidic, right? Or if you have too little water, it's going to get more acidic. So you want to use a volume of water that will completely submerge the crayfish, but not much more than that. You want it to be just a little bit above the top of the crayfish. And this is one place where you're not going to necessarily follow the manual. I think it tells you 75 as a starting point. That might be right, depending on which crayfish you use. But if you need to adjust that, pay attention to whatever your volume is that you use, and use exactly that same volume for the plant. Make sense? Okay. That's what I wanted to cover. Now just get a feel for it. Like I said, today is not the stuff you're writing up. Tomorrow, next time is. So in addition to just going through this as a dry run, think about what you want to manipulate as an independent variable. Your dependent variable is the amount of sodium hydroxide that you need to add in order to titrate the solution. But for your experiment next time, there is something that you can manipulate as the independent variable. And by the way, you don't necessarily have to use animal and plant next time. Today you do. But you could use just animal under two conditions or just plant under two conditions. It's up to you. Okay? That is it. Now, when it comes to another thing that's different from the manual is that it... What does it even call it? I forget. It says to ask your instructor for culture solution. We're not doing that. We're using deionized water. Okay? Now, you wouldn't want to keep a crayfish in deionized water forever. But for the minutes that you use it today, it's fine as long as you put it back into its regular water that it lives in. Because they are different. Anyway, as long as you're using water that's either just pure DI water that has had a crayfish or a plant in it, you can put that down the drain. That's fine. The stuff you want to make sure you put in the jugs today, though, is anything that you've added NaOH to. And just remember, you never have an animal down here when you're delivering NaOH into it. And don't put phenolphthalein in the solution until after you take the animal out. Okay, that's it.